All right, thank you very much. And thank you for having me here today. Just one little modification on that introduction, Ken. Yeah. I'm the only person in history who's been chairman of the Ag Committee three times in the Senate. First one was for 17 days. And we had one hearing, and that was to confirm Ann Veneman, Secretary of Agriculture. Then we lost control of the Senate. Then Jim Jeffords came over, and I picked it up again just in time to be chairman for the 2001 Farm Bill. And then we lost it again, and then picked it up again in the last Congress. So I've been chairman three times of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Before that, I said, when I came here, this place looks familiar. I spent 10 years on the Ag Committee over here on the House side before I went to the Senate. So this is, I guess, put them both together, this is my 35th year on the Ag Committee, either here in the House or in the Senate. Mark Halverson over here getting his coffee is my staff director and has been, he's been on my Ag Committee since I came to the Senate. And farms, has his own farm in Iowa and continues to farm and be my staff director. So a lot of you know Mark Halverson. Grant Gustafson back there does all my ag press and stuff like that. You might know him better than you know Mark. I don't know. Well, let me just, every Wednesday morning I have a constituent breakfast for Iowans in the Washington area who are here, and that starts, surely I'm not here at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm surely if my alarm didn't get me mistaken. I looked up that way at 8:30 this morning. So I'll try to be as rapid as possible. I know you have some questions. Let me just mention a few topics I think are interesting to you that we're going to be working on, I think, this year. First of all, as you know, I chaired a hearing wearing another hat that I have on appropriations as chairman of the Health Appropriations Subcommittee. Had a hearing yesterday on the flu outbreak for a couple of reasons. One, to get information out to people, to allay some fears about what was going on. But I think one of the most important things that came out is that swine flu is not the right name for this. Now, it only picked it up because the first diagnosed case of this in Mexico was from a young boy who happened to live near some pig farms. So all of a sudden, they started calling it swine flu. But as we pointed out with the scientists yesterday from NIH and from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, not one pig in America or in Mexico or anywhere they can find in the world has ever had this. So why it's called swine flu is beyond me. It's just something they picked up and bandied about. Well, the World Health Organization, which is the OIE, which is the standard for world health, said that it would be more accurate to call the virus the North American flu because it started in North America, and we know of no other place in the world where it has started. So I think it's important to point out that people shouldn't be afraid of eating pork. Trading partners who are cutting down on importing pork because of this are not following scientific evidence, because there's absolutely no evidence this has anything to do with pork whatsoever, and no pigs have it. So I think just another indication you can't always believe what you read. See, I'm saying that to all of you that not in the print media see that. So I hope you'll help get this message out. It's a very important message, and I hope that you will help get it out. Now, shifting gears, today, of course, the big day, 100th day of Obama's administration. And I think I would just say a couple words about the economy. We're all suffering in this economy. Hopefully, we're seeing some bottoming out, some stabilization because of the stimulus bill and other things. But we in agriculture haven't been immune. Commodity prices have fallen. Credit's harder to obtain. Biofuels industry is struggling. And USDA is predicting that farm income will be less this year. I hope they're wrong. I hope the recovery comes back up, and I hope we'll have a strong year this year. In a moment, I'll talk about reforming our financial system, because we're going to be working on that too. But I just want to talk about two other key things that are critical to putting our economy, as President Obama says, on a rock, not on sand. Rebuilding the foundation of our economy on rock, not sand. The first, I think, is in energy. We know that America's vulnerability to energy price swings and the whims of foreign oil suppliers is inimical to our best interests in this country. Charting a wiser energy path offers two major benefits. We'll have a stronger and more resilient economy if we are energy secure, not at the mercy of others. And two, creating this energy security for our nation will strongly promote new jobs and economic recovery and growth. And keep in mind, a large share of those jobs and economic growth will occur in rural communities, because that's where renewable energy is mostly produced. We need federal leadership to allow, A, higher ethanol blends, B, to put more flex fuel vehicles on the road, 3, to develop pipeline transport for ethanol, and 4, we need to make sure that tax incentives are extended well into the future to remove any doubts that may inhibit investments in wind power. Now, a lot of people can say, well, we put a lot of energy in our farm bill, and the 2001 farm bill was the first time, and we did it on the Senate side, we put in an energy title. And we've been promoting energy in our farm bill. People say, what's that got to do with agriculture? I said, well, everything. And rural America, not just agriculture, but rural America. Obviously, if you're going to build windmills, a lot of windmills, there's only two places you're really going to build them, rural America or offshore. You're not going to build them in the cities. So rural America has a lot to offer and to gain from this. Healthcare reform is also a critical part of rebuilding our economy, but that may not be the only reason for healthcare reform, but I think it's one big reason for it. When automobile companies are spending more for healthcare insurance than they're paying for the steel that goes into cars, you know something's wrong. So this year, as the chair of the Rural Health Caucus, co-chair of the Rural Health Caucus with Senator Roberts, we are making sure that this healthcare reform addresses the particular problems and needs of rural Americans. Many in rural areas are self-employed, so the cost of health insurance in the non-group market is a big issue. Rural hospitals and other health providers lack the resources to cover their costs. And the main cause of that is the discrimination in the Medicare reimbursement system. Hospitals, physicians, ambulance companies, home health agencies face a disadvantage in Medicare payments compared to same providers in other parts of the country. In addition, we need to provide new incentives to attract health professionals to rural areas. So as a senior member of the Health Committee, I'm chairing the working group that's chairing the prevention and public health components of health reform legislation. I say that because in the agriculture, we're going to be dealing this year with, I think, one important part of prevention and wellness. And that's what I call the child nutrition, reauthorization of the child nutrition bill this year. Scientific research and common sense tells us that good nutrition leads to better health leads to happier, more productive lives, and lower health care costs. That's where the child nutrition bill comes in. Right now, and not only will it be better for our kids and getting them off to a healthier start, but it'll provide opportunities for agricultural producers, particularly those in the local community. In the last farm bill, we took a major step in this area. Up until the last farm bill passed, there was a prohibition in law against school districts giving a preference to local foods. So they had to buy processed foods. Well, we took that away. And so now school districts and stuff can now begin to go out and buy local foods. Now, this will help. When you think about it, who makes most of the money when schools are serving highly processed foods or peddling loads of candy, chips, and soda pop to kids in vending machines? Who makes the money? Food processors. I suppose vending machine owners too, I guess, whoever they are, but not the agricultural producers. My aim is to connect more farmers with their local schools. That will allow us to provide better, fresher foods for our school children. It will help farmers and ranchers to capitalize on new income opportunities. Now again, to achieve these opportunities, we're going to need some additional money. The President has proposed an additional $1 billion per year for the next 10 years to boost this child nutrition program and to get better food in our schools for kids. The last thing is we have to set better standards for the types of foods that may be sold to kids in schools. Right now, the Secretary of Agriculture has the authority to regulate food only in the lunchroom. So that means a kid can leave the lunchroom where we have healthy and good and nutritious food and go down the hall and buy potato chips or candy or soda pop or whatever else in the vending machines. I have proposed for some time that we give the Secretary of Agriculture the authority to regulate all the food in the schools so you don't have this situation. And we're going to to put that in the child nutrition reauthorization bill. And lastly, not only giving the Secretary that authority, we need national school nutrition standards based upon the National Academy of Sciences recommendations. So we have national standards. We haven't changed those. We haven't looked at those, I think, in over 30 years. And we know a lot more now than we did 30 years ago. Finally, let me just talk about reforming our financial system. With all of the stuff that's been going on in the last year about our banks and about Wall Street and stuff, we can see that we have had a failure in our regulatory system. And one of the most egregious of these, of course, AIG, and what they were doing with derivatives. Now, some of us back in the 90s warned against this. I was one of a handful who voted against deregulation of the Glass-Steagall Act back in the late 90s. We had a hearing in the Agriculture Committee, which Alan Greenspan was there, talking about how wonderful derivatives were and that we didn't need to regulate them because they would be, quote, self-regulating. Well, we warned against that at that time. So I've introduced legislation to restore transparency, integrity, and proper oversight to the derivatives markets by returning trading to exchanges. What I mean by that is derivatives, by their very nature, are futures contracts. By their very nature, it has to do with something that's going to happen sometime down the road. Well, if that's the case, then they are should come under the jurisdiction of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and I believe that all derivatives must be traded on open exchanges so that we can get the real price discovery justification on the exchanges. They have to meet their requirements they might have to have for reserves on a daily basis. There are those who are saying that, well, but there should be a carve-out for customized derivatives. Well, if you do that, you'll customize every derivative, and you're right back where you start from. So I am proposing that all derivatives be traded on open exchanges. We've had a couple of hearings on that so far. I've introduced legislation. We'll probably have one more hearing on my bill, and then we'll move ahead with it at that time. In addition, one other thing is I think we need to take another look at position limits on physical commodities, not just derivatives, physical commodities. We want to do everything appropriate, again, to assure that the commodity futures markets perform their price discovery function without distortion or interior manipulation. Now, again, I don't have a date set up for markup, but we're moving ahead on that, and hopefully we'll have something done by that on that sometime this year. So those are just a few things I wanted to touch upon that we're focusing a lot of attention on. And with that, I'd be glad to open it up for your questions. Yes. Well, if done right, Secretary Vilsack is correct. It could be a good plus for agriculture in that we can then begin to sell credits for carbon sequestration by doing things like, CRP ground, that's long-term pasture land. Farmers who want to do rotational grazing, have more grazing ground, also for minimum tillage or no-till, which you can then sequester carbon for longer periods of time. Those all ought to be a part of it. Not to mention, of course, privately owned forests and reserves like that. That can also be a part of this. There's some talk about having this deal with how you do trade-offs on land use. So that if you use land for one purpose, for fuels production and that, how does it affect land someplace else? I'm telling you, I've never seen anyone come up with any good formula on that. So I'm not so concerned about that right now. And let me just say that this whole cap and trade and this climate change legislation, I just don't see how it gets on the docket this year. We've got health care. We'll probably have an energy bill, but that won't be cap and trade or anything like that. It'll be more on wind energy, renewable energies, things like that, tax credits, some of the things I mentioned, but it won't have anything to do with climate change whatsoever. May happen next year, but I just don't see it happening this year. So again, I can assure you that those of us who represent rural areas and agriculture are going to watch it closely, and we're going to make sure that if there is a cap and trade system, and I'm not sold on that. I'm not sold. I'm much more inclined to just say, let's just have a straight carbon tax. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's understandable, it gets to the root of the problem, and you can build in subsidies for low-income people and things like that. So this whole cap and trade, I still have questions about it. How do you know that the sellers are going to do what they say? Well, they say they got satellite images and stuff like that, but I don't know that that really answers the question. What I mean by that, to just elaborate a little bit longer, is if you're a polluter, if you're a power plant or something like that, and you can't meet certain requirements, then what you do is you buy the credits from someone that has a forest or something like that that sequesters carbon. How do you know they're going to continue to do what they say they're going to do? No one knows that. So there's a lot of talk about cap and trade and that, but believe me, there's a lot of hurdles to overcome before we actually get to that position. But my bottom line is, if they do move in that direction, and there's the support for it, a number of us are going to make sure that agriculture has its rightful seat at that table and that they can partake in selling credits for sequestration. Yeah.
Senator, animal ID.
Well, look, first of all, I must say that I think the past administration just bungled this whole thing. Now, I've talked a lot to Secretary Vilsack about it. He has set up, a working group, if I'm not mistaken, to look at this and to make some recommendations, which I think is the right way to go. I don't think there's really kind of no doubt in my mind that we're headed towards some form of animal ID system in this country. It's got to be, comprehensive, but it has to be fair. And you have to ask, who's the beneficiary? Who's the beneficiary? Well, people are saying now, if we're going to have any kind of outbreaks of animal diseases and stuff or terrorist activities, that we need to be able to trace this. Well, I think that's probably right. But who's the beneficiary? Is it the producer? Is it the general public? That's why I have fought ever since my first day on this committee here against those who want to pay for animal inspection for slaughter inspections at our slaughter plants, to have that paid for by the owners of the plants. I said no, it should be paid for by the public because it's our protection. It's the public protection that ought to be paying for that. That's why I've always fought to keep our inspectors, our meat inspectors, plants, even after we went to the HACCP program, keep that under public control, paid for by the public. And that's how I see animal ID. I mean, it's for the protection of the public. But it's got to be, you can't just have bits and pieces here and there and say, well, we're going to do it here but not here. It's got to be comprehensive. If we're going to have an animal ID system, it's got to be comprehensive. But basically, I'm just going to wait and see what the review shows us. I don't know that we have a date on that. I don't think Secretary Vilsack put a date on it, certain. I just know he set up this study and this review. So we'll wait and see what that review says. Back.
Senator Hartner, are you looking at some possible other ways to help support the dairy producers?
dairy. Well, again, we've been encouraging the secretary to do more purchases, as you know. They have done some. There is some culling going on, as you know, in certain parts of the country. But again, looking at different markets, how we utilize non-fat dry milk solids in this country for government purchase, for part of our food aid programs abroad, that I think we need to put more emphasis on that. But I think the dairy industry right now is going through a really kind of a tough period. A lot of consolidation. And with new methods of transportation, I mean, my gosh, I found out just a little while ago, I mean about last year, we're transporting milk from California to Lamar's, Iowa for Wells Blue Bunny ice cream. We never used to be able to do that before. So now we're shipping milk all over the country. So I have always tried to steer clear of trying to sort of just benefit one region over the other, to try to make sure that we have a steady supply of fluid milk, at least throughout the year at a reasonable price, that we don't get back in the situation where we have the sort of the spring flush and milk prices go all to heck, and in the middle of the winter they go sky high. That's what the dairy programs were set up to do, was to stop that from happening, and they've worked well. What kind of dairy program we're going to have in the future to respond to the new production methodologies and the transportation systems that we have now, the new types of treatment of milk. I just looked at my milk in my refrigerator this morning when I had my cereal, and the expiration date was sometime in June. I never saw this before. So there's new ways of treating milk that it lasts longer in your refrigeration. These are just all the kind of new realities and how we're going to deal with that. Well, right now I don't know. I'm just saying right now do everything we can to try to remove some of the dairy products to get them into some of our feeding programs. It comes at a time when we do have to do more for the Women, Infants, and Children's program, for our food banks around the country because of unemployment, and some of our food aid programs. So I think there's more that we can do as a government there. But long term, you'll see a lot of debates around here on what we're going to do long term. Are we going to have, what's the word I'm looking at, regional compacts around the country? We're going to have different regional compacts. Some people have been promoting that. Or we're going to have just one big compact for the United States. A lot of different suggestions on this, and no decision has been made, and quite frankly, I've made no decision myself on that.
Senator, we want to keep you on the task.
Well, let me answer a couple more before I go. I'll be really short, yes. Well, again, one of the big debates here is going to be whether we have a public plan or not. And, again, I don't know how that debate is going to unfold. I mean, how the end is going to, what the end is going to be. I think there's a lot of support for a basic public plan that anyone can join, but that if you want to layer it with better plans, what we call Cadillac plans, you can do that. But there will be some, and then we will have in any private plan that's out there, we will have certain requirements that they have to have. I think it will probably wind up looking more like what we have here, the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, than it will any kind of Canadian plan. That's where I think we're headed. Yes. Well, I think, first of all, I think President Obama did a wise thing in picking Tom Vilsack to be Secretary of Agriculture. I think we've got some really top-notch people down there that Secretary Vilsack has put in place. President Obama has given very clear signals that he is a supporter of our biofuels programs in this country and wants to pursue that. Needless to say, he has done a lot for wind energy, too, going to Iowa the other day to promote the development of wind energy in this country. He has also, I think, been very supportive and understanding of production, as they say, production agriculture, the program crops that we've had in agriculture for a long period of time. And don't forget, he comes from a state, and when he was in the state Senate, was very supportive of Illinois agriculture. And, of course, a lot of us who associated with him, and when he was running for president, he spent a lot of time in my state, as you probably know, and I think he has a better feel for agriculture. So I give him pretty high marks, and especially what he's done with the recovery program and what we're doing, some of the things I mentioned in terms of rural America, his health care program, his energy programs, some of the broadband programs that we put in the stimulus bill to get broadband out to rural America. And I don't mean to belabor this, but sometimes I say, you know, it's not just what we do here that immediately helps a production farmer. It's also what we do to build up the infrastructure around that farmer. What kind of communities do they have? What kind of transportation? What kind of schools? What kind of health care? What kind of markets are they able to access? All of those go to help agriculture, too. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of from this administration, is that infrastructure support.
It looks like the administration is lining up behind these remaining three FTAs. Do you think we'll get those passed or ratified out this year?
I don't know. You're talking about Korea and
Colombia.
Well, the most important being Korea, obviously. And I think I've been pushing for a long time to move ahead on Korea. The other two are a little bit more problematic. I don't know. I just don't know whether we're going to get to those this year or not. I just think there's a lot of problems there. Hopefully we can get... Let me put it this way: if the choice is none of them, because they're all bundled together, or one of them by separating them out, which is Korea, I'm in favor of the latter. Yes.
Senator, crop insurance took a small hit in the budget process on the Senate side. Do you expect that to survive in the conference?
Crop insurance? Yes, I believe so. As you know, we took a lot of money out of crop insurance for the last farm bill. So they took some pretty good hits. Now, will there be some more shaving done on it? Well, there are those that are proposing that some of the reimbursement formulas need to be changed a little bit. We're looking at that right now, and that could be something that might happen. But again, I think... We need a better assessment of that, and let's look at what the impact has been on crop insurance from what we did in last year's farm bill, which ink is hardly dry on the paper. And let's see how that works before we go rushing off to take any more out of crop insurance. I got
to
go. Thank you all very much. Appreciate what you do. Thank you.